Epilogue. Now that my own children are grown, I have come to believe that one of the most important things a parent can do is learn to let go. Not completely, of course. You can't do that because your children never stop being your children. There will be times when they call upon you to help them raise their own kids, as our parents did for us. There will be times when the stresses of life require you to turn back the clock and be their primary source of comfort and reassurance. But it's crucial to recognize when it's time to get out of your kids' way. Dad managed this brilliantly. In the late 1970s, we founded a company called Major H Productions that was built around the Howard name and the idea of collaboration between Dad, Clint, and me. We did a few made-for-TV films, including the one that Clint and I wrote, Cotton Candy, and an Emmy-nominated kids movie entitled Through the Magic Pyramid that Dad wrote and I directed. Major H served its purpose for a time, but I craved more ambitious projects and the opportunity to helm a big studio picture. In the early 1980s, I met a bright, hustling young TV movie producer on the Paramount lot named Brian Grazer. We hit it off both personally and creatively. Brian was bursting with ideas, and he conceived the stories for what became my second and third feature films, Night Shift and Splash. I watched in awe and gratitude as Brian fearlessly navigated the Hollywood studio system to get these movies produced and distributed by major studios. Night Shift was a sleeper success for Warner Brothers. Splash, a Disney production, was my first bona fide hit, landing in that year's box office top 10 and receiving Golden Globe and Oscar nominations. My working relationship with Brian was clearly working. He and I decided to stick together and create our own independent production shop, which we named Imagine Entertainment. This marked the end of Major H Productions, a changing of the guard. Dad had no stake in this new company. Yet he never guilt-tripped me for seeking out other collaborators and business partners, nor did Mom pressure me to continue working with Dad. They let me follow my instincts that they themselves helped hone, while maintaining our familial closeness. What a gift that was, to let me fly away the way Opie let his baby birds fly free at the end of Opie the Birdman. It was their final act in raising me and positioning me for success in our shared field of work, a tremendous act of love and grace. I wasn't the only Howard to take flight. In the 1980s, Mom returned to acting for the first time since Dad pressed her into service for the shows that he directed on the Air Force Base. It started with me putting her in Cocoon as a featured extra who worked on the film for several weeks. Then Henry Winkler cast her and Dad in small parts in a Dolly Parton holiday movie he was directing, A Smoky Mountain Christmas. Henry had already done me a major solid by agreeing to star alongside Michael Keaton in Night Shift. I wouldn't have received the necessary financing for the film without someone of his status attached. Newly alive to performing, Mom started going out on auditions. Before long, she had effectively cornered the market on little old lady roles in sitcoms, appearing in Roseanne, The Wonder Years, Married with Children, and Grace Under Fire. One day in 1994, when I was preparing Apollo 13, Dad called me. "Ron, I want to ask you something about your casting," he said. I immediately began to wonder if he had a role for himself in mind, which would have been unlike him. He had never, ever promoted himself to me. "I see that in the latest Apollo 13 rewrite, there is a terrific little role for Jim Lovell's mother, Blanche," he said. "I think Jean would knock that out of the park." Okay, now I was in a bit of a dilemma. Dad was leaning on me to cast Mom, but this part wasn't a casual walk-on. Blanche has a major scene in which her daughter-in-law breaks the news to her that there has been an explosion in the command module, putting her son in danger. Blanche, far from breaking down in tears, displays a steely resolve. She reassures her crying granddaughter by saying, "If they could get a washing machine to fly, my Jimmy could land it." I acceded to Dad's request to give his thoughts some serious consideration, but I couldn't play favorites or assume Mom was a natural for the part. I made her audition. I drove to their house, nervous as a cat, and fully prepared to have an awkward, let them down gently conversation. I had been through a version of this before with Dad. In a couple of my films, his best scenes had hit the cutting room floor during the final editing, and I had to break the news. But Mom came prepared. She was immediately and undeniably excellent from a performance standpoint. There was just one problem. For the first time in her adult life, Mom looked too young to be believable. When I expressed this concern, Dad pointed out that makeup could enhance the lines in her face. Then Mom went in for the clothes. She popped out her false teeth, smiled wide, and said, "Don't you think this would do the trick?" "Okay, Mom, okay," I said. "Put your teeth back in. You got the part." We put her in a wheelchair, and the hair and makeup people did fantastic work to make Mom appear convincingly frail and elderly. She nailed the scene in just a couple of takes. It's a favorite of many Apollo 13 fans.
Being the boy who stayed local created a different dynamic for Dad and me than it did for him and Ron. In Dad's later years, he and I were best friends as much as we were father and son. We went to ball games together, hung out together, engaged in shop talk. When I was cast in something, I ran the material by him and sought out his thoughts. Not his guidance, which is what he gave me when I was a kid, but any useful ideas he might have. I didn't always take his suggestions on board, but I treasured our ritual of discussing the work. And Dad clearly appreciated that I solicited his input. And one day in 1998, he came through with a truly great piece of advice. Just weeks before I turned 39, my agent called me with a strange piece of news. He told me that MTV wanted to honor me for lifetime achievement at that year's MTV Movie Awards, the raucous, looser, sillier cousin of the network's higher-profile MTV Video Music Awards. The statue that they gave out to the winners was a gold-plated bucket of popcorn. This phone call happened to come on April 1st, a fact that was not lost on me. A lifetime achievement award? Me? Huh. But even after my agent persuaded me that MTV's offer wasn't an April Fool's joke, I wasn't a total idiot about their intentions. The previous 2 years' winners had been Godzilla and Chewbacca, and the whole thing was tongue-in-cheek. I got it completely that they had picked me because I am a so-called cult actor with a funny look and a resume of weird parts, from Baylock and Ego Bauer to the psychos I played in Evil Speak and The Ice Cream Man. So do I take this offer or not? I weighed my options. I knew that MTV wanted to have some fun at my expense, but I also saw their award show as an opportunity for me as an actor. I was always hustling for work, and I thought to myself, this is better than sending out postcards to every casting director in town, which is what Mom did during her renaissance as an actress. With that in mind, I prepared a self-effacing speech that was basically designed to get laughs, with me as the butt of the joke. I went over to my folks' house and ran the speech by Dad. He listened, but took exception to my approach. In his usual straightforward manner, he said, "Those jokes might get some laughs, but they just won't stick. You should take your acceptance speech seriously, because if you take it seriously, people will remember it." The speech that I actually delivered on May 30th, 1998, after they showed a clip montage of my work, including Baylock saying, "But first, the Tranya," was sincere and heartfelt, a genuine Lifetime Achievement Award speech. I thanked the fans, I thanked the people who hired me, I thanked my family. Then I said, "You know, people come up to me all the time and say, 'Weren't you the little kid with the bear?' Or they say, 'Oh, I remember you. You were that little guy on Star Trek who drank the Tranya.' Or, 'I know you, You're the brother of that famous guy. Or, wait, I know you. You're that crazy guy in that horror movie. And I go, yeah, I'm all those things. Well, maybe now people will come up to me on the street and they'll say, hey, aren't you that guy with the big golden bucket of popcorn? As nervous as I was, I could tell that my sincerity had won the audience over. They laughed in the places where I wanted them to laugh and applauded warmly when I offered them my gratitude. Mike Myers shook my hand and Adam Sandler hugged me. I looked out to see my family in the audience. Mom was too unwell to attend, but Dad, Ron, and Cheryl were there beaming. The suits at MTV were taken by surprise by this turn of events. A moment designed for kitschy laughs had been transformed into a moment of unironic warmth and love. As a result, MTV retired their Lifetime Achievement Award after I received mine. I was far from being a child by that point, but that night, I learned that Rance Howard, the child whisperer, still had it. Mom's health went into steep decline in the year 2000. Her youthful spirit and sense of humor remained, but between the residual issues associated with being hit by a truck in her teens, her years of heavy smoking, and three major heart surgeries, her body started to break down. A hip replacement surgery wasn't enough to stem the cascade of health problems. By late summer, she was bedridden in the hospital, suffering from heart and kidney failure. She was only 73 when she passed, on the 2nd of September. Before she died, Mom and I had some final conversations. She knew her days were numbered and was keen to impart advice to me, even though she was having great difficulty speaking. I was preparing to remodel my home. Had she been well, Mom would have been asking me about my plans and talking a mile a minute, offering up suggestions. She could no longer do that. But she was aware that I was already experiencing some pain in my hips, a condition that she knew all too well. Summoning every ounce of strength she had, Mom motioned for me to draw closer to her. Her mouth to my ear, she uttered three words, twice. Get a jacuzzi. Get a jacuzzi. These were sage words, for I've used my jacuzzi every day, twice a day, since the day I had it installed. Thanks, Mom. More meaningfully, she told me that the thing I had done that made her the most proud had nothing to do with my acting career. It was putting the plug in the jug, getting sober. She was happy for me, and tremendously relieved I hadn't conceded defeat to drink as her father had. At Mom's funeral, I placed my 9-year sobriety chip from AA in her coffin. I beat myself up a little for not getting sober sooner. It would have been better to leave a chip with a nice round number 10 on it. But that was just ego nonsense. Mom went to her grave knowing that I was well, and that's what matters.
The last significant conversation I had with Mom was also at her bedside. By then, her ability to speak was all but gone. I could see from her facial expression that she was burning to tell me something and was frustrated by her inability to do so. Mom, do you want to write what you want to say? She nodded yes. I found a clipboard and a pen. She labored for a long time over her words. It caused her physical pain even to write. Once she was done, I took the clipboard from her. It contained a single sentence that was hard to decipher in her crabbed, compromised handwriting, but I figured it out. She had written, "Rance loves to act." In other words, I should keep hiring him and putting him in my movies whenever I could. It sounds like a final funny example of a mother being pushy, but I recognized it as an expression of her deep and abiding love for Dad. She knew more than anyone that he had a need to express himself through his creative work, a desire that burned in him since they first met in the late 1940s. But Dad seldom had real opportunities to fulfill this desire. Most of the parts he got in his career weren't particularly big or juicy. Mom still believed he had time. Acting was the Howard family business. Saying Rance loves to act was her way of saying, take care of your father. Dad was gutted after Mom's death. Were it not for his passion for acting, I don't know if he would have been able to keep going for another 17 years, working almost to the very end. While Mom was the love of his life, Dad was a serial monogamist who didn't function well by himself. He was fortunate to find happiness not long after Mom died with a woman named Judy Jacobson, who had also recently lost her spouse. They were married from 2001 until Judy's Alzheimer's disease-related death in 2017. Dad's indefatigable drive to keep auditioning should be an inspiration to all working actors. When he was 84, he won a part in a prestige picture, Alexander Payne's Nebraska, playing a brother of Bruce Dern's raggedy ne'er-do-well lead character. Bruce received an Academy Award nomination for his performance. At one of the awards ceremonies that season, he sought me out on the red carpet. He wanted to convey to me, emphatically, how grateful he was to Dad for his performance. He was so fucking real, man, that I realized what the movie could be, Bruce said. I knew that I would have to step up to that level of honesty. This was both gratifying and funny, because back in the 1960s, now it can be told, Bruce had been one of the guys on Dad's list of rat bastard actors who were stealing his parts. Though it's been years since I played a fictional character on TV or in a movie, I did get to act with Dad one last time in a super meta episode of Arrested Development. I was that show's co-executive producer and off-screen narrator for the duration of its run. In its final season, there was an episode in which Michael and George Michael Bluth, the characters played by Jason Bateman and Michael Cera, attend a backyard barbecue hosted by the actual Howard family. Cheryl and I played exaggerated versions of ourselves, as did all four of our kids, Bryce, Paige, Jocelyn, and Reed. The coup de grace of this self-referential pageant was a scene in which Dad, at the age of 88, sent up his role as the all-knowing patriarch. In the episode, Michael Bluth, while sneaking around the pretend Howard mansion, chances upon Rance Howard sitting before a bank of surveillance screens in his office, snooping on his family like Big Brother. The scene is played for laughs, but it's not entirely untrue to who Dad was. I like to stay busy. Kind of keep an eye on my son, too, he tells Michael. Oh yeah, you still have to do that, Michael says. That's a father's job, Dad says. Doesn't start at 9 and end at 5. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Even as they get older, huh? That gets even harder, Dad said. They think they know it all. You still have to be there for them when they make mistakes. Or sometimes they need to cry a little bit. Because sometimes a person needs to cry a little bit. Unless that person is a dad.
I was lucky to have one last go-around with Pop on a set. His final film was a little indie road movie called Appleseed. For the first time in his life, he was indisputably a leading man, playing the elderly ex-con who tries to warn off a younger man from making the mistakes that he made. I was cast as Dad's long-estranged son, who had not seen his father since the older man was incarcerated for murder a long, long time ago. I had just one scene in Appleseed, toward the end of the movie. Dad and I got together to rehearse it at his Toluca Lake house, the night before he flew east to begin work on the production. I wanted to give him a hero's send-off, so I stopped by the smokehouse to pick up some of their garlic bread, which we Howards consider the world's best, and grilled salmon and asparagus for the two of us. After dinner, we cleared the table and took out our scripts. My character, Huey, is the only person in the film who isn't smitten by this charismatic rogue that Dad played. He has no love for his old man. Preparing for this role meant summoning memories of painful experiences in my life, but none of them pertained to Dad, who I loved unequivocally. As we sat there at the table, I was overcome by gratitude for the privilege of working with my father, and regret that we hadn't acted together as adults more often. We managed to read through the scene once before my eyes filled with tears. I was embarrassed, until I looked up and saw that Dad was crying too. The only other time I ever saw him cry was when Mom passed. It's an actor's dream to have a well of emotion to draw upon. Dad and I pulled ourselves together and exchanged conspiratorial smiles before I went home for the night. We knew that we were going to kick that scene in the ass. A few weeks later, I flew to Vermont to join Dad and the rest of the production team on location. It was just one day's work, but probably the greatest of my life. This was the first time that the two of us had ever done a dramatic scene together. We had been scene partners in Gentle Ben, of course, and a few other projects here and there, but never in anything with such gravity. The day didn't disappoint. One more time, my old man elevated me to another level. I experienced a slight twinge of sadness, though, when the director, Michael Wirth, gently told Dad that he needed to move his script out of the shot. He had been keeping it close by because his memory for learning dialogue was starting to fade. A tough state of affairs for the man who was always prepared. I knew then that the end was near. Rance Howard would pass a couple of months later, but on that beautiful fall day in Vermont, I was blessed to spend time on a set, one last time, with my favorite acting partner, my dad.
Clint, I think it would be interesting to discuss what we learned about ourselves and our family in the course of doing this book. You first.
Thanks for putting me on the spot, bud. Well, I would say that our childhoods were a much wilder, stranger ride than we realized when we were living through them. You don't stop and contemplate the big picture when you're a kid. But now I'm reminded of something that Gary Sinise's character Ken Mattingly says in Apollo 13 at the start of their moon mission. It's going to be one for the books. Our journey has been one for the books, or at least a book.
Absolutely. I've also come to appreciate more deeply the crazy, potentially unwise leap into the unknown that Mom and Dad made when they ran off together to take their chances in show business. I suspect that because of them, I've been subconsciously drawn to the stories of people who take on outsized challenges with little regard for the physical or emotional risks, like astronauts and race car drivers, and flawed geniuses, listening to what's in their heads more than the advice of so-called normal people. And what a blast to revisit and re-examine these memories with you, Clint. Granted, they were not all as rosy as I had originally imagined. I used to think of my journey from the journey to the present as a pretty straight line. But it's been much more of an unpredictable zigzag than I thought. Before we did this, I sometimes fell into the highlight reel mentality, the Andy Griffith Show, The Music Man, American Graffiti, Happy Days, directing. Now I get that I was equally shaped by projects that no one remembers, nor would I want anyone to. The mediocrities and stinkers had a damn near equal effect in determining the path that I followed to adulthood.
Ron, I love you and respect your beautiful mind, but I have a different take. From my chair, I have always seen life as a zigzag. I was never certain of where I was headed. Look at some of the parts I've played, starting at age 7. A 600-year-old alien, a kid with a pet bear, a boy who predicted the end of the world, a young military cadet possessed by the devil, a twisted ice cream man who terrorizes neighborhood children, a nutty but earnest Cajun, and numerous flight controllers. That's not a straight line, but it sure as hell was interesting. My life has been no straight line either. That really came into stark relief when I set it down on paper. But I find myself landing on one thought. I am humbly grateful to God for the life I've lived. Maybe it's my age or my emotions getting the better of me, but I want to sign off by saying, sorry, Mr. Gehrig, I am the luckiest man to walk the face of this earth.
I second that. Can I ask you one more question?
Fire away.
Hey, where's your bear?
Oh, you want to play that game, do you? He's on the floor in front of my fireplace, Opie Cunningham.